This is a CBC podcast.
Support for delivery of this podcast comes from the Buick Enclave, the finest luxury crossover ever. Visit buick.gm.ca to see that where there's passion, there's beauty.
This is Special Delivery, a podcast where short-run series from CBC Radio get a second chance at fame and you get a second chance to listen. I'm Sharon Farrell. The 2007 Massey Lectures are coming up, and the series is called City of Words with best-selling author Alberto Mangel. You can hear it on the CBC Radio 1 program Ideas throughout the week of November the 5th. As a special treat to whet your Massey appetite, we're taking a look back at five of our most memorable Massey Lectures. This week, the opening lecture of the series The Empty Society from social critic Dr. Paul Goodman. He presented the lectures in 1966.
From Toronto, we present The Best of Ideas, the first broadcast in the expanded 1966-67 season. I'm your host, Ken Haslam. This year, the CBC's invited lecturer is Paul Goodman, and his theme, The Moral Ambiguity of America. Dr. Goodman, a social critic, author, and lecturer, is regarded as one of the most penetrating and radical critics of American society. Tonight, The Empty Society by Paul Goodman.
During Eisenhower's second administration, I wrote a book describing how hard it was for young people to grow up in the corporate institutions of American society. Yet the statistics at that time indicated that most were content to be secure as personnel of big corporations. A few deviated in impractical and certainly unpolitical ways, like being beat or delinquent. The system itself, like its president, operated with a cheerful and righteous self-satisfaction. There were no signs of its being vulnerable, although a loud chorus of intellectual critics, like myself, were sounding off against it. We were spoil sports. Less than 10 years later, the feeling is different. It turns out that we critics were not altogether unrealistic. The system of institutions is still grander and more computerized, but it seems to have lost its morale. The baronial corporations are making immense amounts of money and are more openly and heavily subsidized by the monarch in Washington. The processing of the young is extended for longer years and its tempo speeded up. More capital and management are exported, interlocking with international capital, and more of the world, including Canada, is brought under American control. When necessary, remarkable military technology is brought to bear. At home, there is no political check, for no matter what the currents of opinion, by and large, the dominant system wreaks its will, managing the parliamentary machinery to look like consensus. Nevertheless, the feeling of justification is gone. Sometimes we seem to be bullying it through only in order to save face. Often enterprises seem to be expanding simply because the managers cannot think of any other use of energy and resources. The economy is turning into a war economy. There are warnings of ecological disaster, pollution, congestion, poisoning, mental disease, anomie. We have discovered that there is hardcore poverty at home that is not easy to liquidate. Abroad, unlike the success of the Marshall Plan in Europe in the 40s, it increasingly appears that poverty and unrest in Asia, Africa, and South America are not helped by our methods of assistance, but are perhaps made worse. There are flashes of suspicion, like flashes of lightning, that the entire system may be unviable. And now, very many young people no longer want to cooperate with such a system. Indeed, a large and rapidly growing number, already more than 5% of college students, use language that is openly revolutionary or apocalyptic, as if in their generation they were going to make the French Revolution. More and more often, direct civil disobedience seems to make obvious sense. We are exerting more power and feeling less right. What does that mean for the future? I have heard serious people argue for three plausible yet drastically incompatible predictions about America during the next generation, none of them happy. Some feel, with a kind of Virgilian despair, that the American empire will succeed and will impose for a long time, at home and abroad, its meaningless management and showy style of life. For instance, we will win in Vietnam, though such a victory of brute military technology would be a moral disaster. Clubbing together with the other nuclear powers, we will stave off the nuclear war and stop history with the new Congress of Vienna. American democracy will vanish into an establishment of promoters, mandarins, and technicians, although for a while maintaining an image of democracy, as in the days of Augustus and Tiberius. And all this is probably the best possible outcome, given the complexities of high technology, urbanization, mass education, and overpopulation. Others believe, with dismay and horror, that our country is overreaching and is bound for doom. But nothing can be done because policy cannot be influenced. Controlling communications, creating incidents that it then mistakes for history, deceived by its own intelligence agents, our system is mesmerized. Like the Mikado, Washington is captive of its military-industrial complex. The way we manage the economy and technology must increase anarchy and crime. Since the war economy eats up brains and capital, we will soon be a fifth-rate economic power. With a few setbacks abroad, for instance, when we force a major South American country to become communist, and with the increasing disorder on the streets that is inevitable because our cities are unworkable, there will be a police state. The atom bombs may then go off. Such being the forecast, the part of wisdom is escape. And those who cultivate LSD are on the right track. Others hold that the Americans are too decent to succumb to fascism and too spirited to remain impotent clients of a managerial elite, and the tide of protest will continue to rise. We must invent new forms. To be sure, the present climate of emergency is bad for the social invention and experiment that are indispensable, and there is no doubt that establishment methods of organization make everybody stupid from top to bottom. But there is hope precisely in the young. They understand the problem in their bones. Of course, they don't know much, and their disaffection both from tradition and from the adult world makes it hard for them to learn anything. Nevertheless, we will learn in the inevitable conflict, which will hopefully be mainly nonviolent. I myself hold this third view. American society is on a bad course, but there is hope for reconstruction through conflict. I am eager, as well as honored, to be talking to a Canadian audience on the state of American society, and especially to the Canadian young. You people are not yet so wrongly committed as we. Your land is less despoiled, your cities are more manageable, you are not yet so sold on mass miseducation. You are not in the trap of militarism. A large minority of you are deeply skeptical of American methods and oppose the unquestioned extension of American power. Some of us Americans have always wistfully hoped that you Canadians would teach us a lesson or two, though, to be frank, you have usually let us down. In these lectures on our ambiguous moral position, I shall have to talk a good deal about style. To illustrate the current style of American enterprise, let me analyze a small actual incident. It is perfectly typical, banal. Washington has allotted several billions of dollars to the schools. The schools are not teaching very well, but there is no chance that anybody will upset the apple cart and ask if so much doing of lessons is the right way to educate the young altogether. Rather, there is a demand for new methods and mechanical equipment which will disturb nobody, and electronics is the latest thing that every forward-looking local school board must be proud to buy. So to cut in on this melon, electronics corporations, IBM, Xerox, etc., have hastened to combine with or take over textbook houses. My own publisher, Random House, has been bought up by the Radio Corporation of America. Just now, General Electric and Time Incorporated, that owns a textbook house, have put nearly $40 million into a joint subsidiary called General Learning. And an editor of Life magazine, a part of Time, Inc., has been relieved of his duties for 5 weeks in order to prepare a prospectus on the broad educational needs of America and the world, to come up with exciting proposals so that general learning can move with purpose into this unaccustomed field. The editor has collected and is boning up on the latest high thought on education, and in due course he invites me to lunch to pick my brains for something new and radical. The sky, he assures me, is the limit. I am known, let me explain, as a severe critic of the school establishment. Perhaps, he tells me at lunch, there is no unique place for general learning. They'll probably end up as prosaic makers of school hardware, but we ought to give it a try. Consider the premises of this odd situation. We're first to have the organization and the technology, and then they try to dream up a use for it. The competence required is to have a big organization and sales force, and to be in, to have the prestige and connections plausibly to get the subsidy. Usually it is good to have some minimal relation to the ostensible function, for example, a textbook, subsidiary, related to schooling, or time life related to, let us say, learning. But indeed, when an expanding corporation becomes very grand, it generates an expertise of its own called systems development, applicable to anything. For example, as an expert in systems development, North American Aviation is hired to reform the penal system of California. There is no longer need to demonstrate acquaintance with any particular human function. Naturally, with the divorce of enterprise from utility and competence, there goes a heavy emphasis on rhetoric to prove utility and competence. So an editor must be reassigned for 5 weeks to write a rationale. It is his task to add ideas or talking points to the enterprise, like a rapper. The personnel of expanding corporations, of course, are busy people and have not had time to think of many concrete ideas. They can, however, phone writers and concerned professionals. Way out radicals especially do a lot of thinking, since they have little practical employment. And since the enterprise is free-floating anyway, it is dandy to include in the prospectus something daring or even meaningful. In an affluent society that can afford it, there is something jolly about such an adventure of the electronics giant, the mighty publisher, the National Science Foundation that has made curriculum studies, and local school boards that want to be in the swim. Somewhere down the line, however, this cabal of decision-makers is going to coerce the time of life of real children and control the activity of classroom teachers. These who are directly engaged in the human function of learning and teaching have no say in what goes on. This introduces a more sober note. Some of the product of the burst of corporate activity and technological virtuosity will be useful, some not. The pedagogical evidence is mixed and not extensive. But the brute fact is that the children are quite incidental to the massive intervention of the giant combination. I have chosen a wry example, but I could have chosen the leader of the American economy, the complex of cars, oil, and roads. This outgrew its proper size perhaps 30 years ago. Now it is destroying both the cities and the countryside. It has been shown to be careless of even elementary safety. Rather, let me turn abruptly to the Vietnam War. We notice the same family traits. Whatever made us embark on this adventure, by now we can define the Vietnam War as a commitment looking for a reason, or at least a rationalization. There has been no lack of policy statements, rhetorical gestures, manufactured incidents, and certainly plain lies. But as the war has dragged on and grown, all these have proved to be mere talking points. Ringing true, however, has been the fanfare about the superb military technology that we have deployed. The theme is used as a chief morale builder for the troops. In the absence of adequate political reasons, some have even said that the war is largely an occasion for testing new hardware and techniques. It is eerie to hear, on the television, an airman enthusiastically praise the split-second scheduling of his missions to devastate rice fields. Yet what emerges most strikingly from our thinking about and prosecution of the Vietnam War is, again, the input-output accounting, the systems development, and the purely incidental significance of the human beings involved. The communique are concerned mainly with the body count of VC in ratio to our own losses. Since there is a theory that in wars of this kind, one must attain a ratio of 5 to 1 or 10 to 1. According to various estimates, it costs $50,000 to $250,000 to kill one Vietnamese, hopefully an enemy. Similarly, the bombing of civilians and the destructions of their livelihood occur as if no human beings were involved. They are officially spoken of as unfortunate but incidental. We claim that we have no imperialist aims in Vietnam, though we are building air bases of some very heavy concrete and steel. But evidently, old-fashioned imperialism was preferable, since it tried to keep the subjugated population in existence for taxes and labor. At home, correspondingly, college students are deferred from the draft because, it is said, they will be necessary to man the professions and scientific technology, while farm boys, Negroes, and Spanish Americans are drafted because they are otherwise good for nothing. That is to say, war is not regarded as a dread emergency in which each one does his bit, but as part of the ongoing business of society in which fighting and dying are usual categories of the division of labor. But this is bound to be the case when 20% of the gross national product is spent on war using a multiplier of 2. When more than half of the gross investment since 1945 has been in war industry, and when much of higher education and science is devoted to war technology. The Americans are not a warlike or bloodthirsty people, though violent. The dehumanizing of war is part of a general style of enterprise and control in which human utility and even the existence of particular human beings are simply not a paramount consideration. Great armaments manufacturers have said that they are willing and ready to convert their capital and skill to peaceful production when given the signal. This seems to mean that it is indifferent to them what they enterprise. Studies of American workmen have shown that they take their moral and aesthetic standards not from family, church, friends, or personal interests, but from the organization and style of work at the plant. And I think that this explains the present peculiar situation that other nations of the world regard our behavior in the Vietnam War with a kind of horror, whereas Americans sincerely talk as if it were a messy job to be done as efficiently as possible. This brings us to a broader question. What do we mean by technical efficiency in our system? Corporate and bureaucratic societies, whether ruled by priests, mandarins, generals, or business managers, have always tended to diminish the importance of personal needs and human feeling. Nevertheless, modern corporate societies that wield a high technology are liable to a unique temptation. Since they do not exploit common labor, they may tend to exclude the majority of human beings altogether as useless for the needs of the system, and therefore as not quite persons. This has been the steady tendency in America. The aged are ruled out at an earlier age, the young until a later age. We have liquidated most small farmers. There is no place for the poor, for example, more than 20 million Negroes and Latin Americans. A rapidly increasing number are certified as insane or otherwise incompetent. These groups already comprise more than a majority of the American population. Some authorities say, although others deny, that with full automation, most of the rest will also be useless. There is nothing malevolent or heartless in this exclusion. The tone is not like that of the old exploitative society when people were thrown out of work during the lows of the business cycle. For humane and political reasons, even extraordinary efforts are made to shape the excluded into the dominant style so they can belong. Even though the system is going to need only a few percent with elaborate academic training, all the young are subjected to 12 years of schooling and 40% go to college. There is every kind of training and social service to upgrade the poor and to make the handicapped productive members of society. At high cost of effort and suffering, mentally retarded children must be taught to read, if only cat and rat. But a frank look shows, I think, that for most, the long schooling is a way of keeping the young on ice. The job training is busy work, and the social services turn people into community dependents for generations. Much of the anxiety about the handicapped and the underprivileged is suburban squeamishness that cannot tolerate difference. What is never done is to change the rules of the system, to redefine usefulness in terms of how people are, and to shape the dominant style to people. This cannot be done because it would be inefficient and indeed degrading, for there is only one right way to exist. Do it our way, or else you are not quite a person. Inevitably, such self-righteous inflexibility is self-mesmerizing and self-proving, for other methods and values are not allowed to breathe and prove themselves. Often it would be cheaper to help people to be in their own way, or at least to let them be. But anything in a different or outmoded style has deviant or underprivileged written on it, and no expense is spared to root it out in the name of efficiency. Thus, it would have been cheaper to pay the small farmers to stay put if they wished. It would be far cheaper to give money directly to the urban poor to design their own lives, rather than to try to make them shape up. Very many of the young would get a better education and grow up usefully to themselves and society if the school money were used for real apprenticeships, or even if they were given the school money to follow their own interests, ambitions, and even fantasies, rather than penning them up for lengthening years in increasingly regimented institutions. But none of these simpler and cheaper ways would be efficient. The clinching proof is that they would be hard to administer. Also, are the people useless? The concept of efficiency is largely systemic. It depends on the goals of the system, which may be too narrowly and inflexibly conceived. It depends on the ease of administration, which is considered as more important than economic or social costs. It depends also on the method of calculating costs, which may create a false image of efficiency by ruling out intangibles that do not happen to suit the method. This source of error becomes very important in advanced urban economies where the provision of personal and social services grows rapidly in proportion to hardware and food production and distribution. In providing services, whether giving information, selling, teaching children, admitting to college, assigning jobs, serving food, or advising on welfare, standardization and punch cards may seem to fulfill the function, but they may do so at the expense of frayed nerves, waiting in line, bad mistakes, misfitting, and cold soup. In modern conditions, the tailor-made improvisations of fallible but responsive human beings may be increasingly indispensable rather than useless. In the jargon of Frank Riesman, there is a great need for sub-professionals. Yet the mass production and business machine style, well adapted to manufacturing hardware and calculating logistics, will decide that people are useless anyway, since they can theoretically be dispensed with. It is a curious experience to hear a gentleman from the Bureau of the Budget explain the budget of the war on poverty according to cost-benefit computation. He can demonstrate that the participation of the poor in administering a program is disadvantageous. He can show you the flow chart. He cannot understand why poor people make a fuss on this point. It is useless to explain to him that they do not trust the program, nor the director, but would like to get the money for their own purposes. Abroad, the Americans still engage in plenty of old-fashioned exploitation of human labor, as in Latin America. Yet the tendency is again to regard the underdeveloped peoples as not quite persons, and to try to shape them up by sometimes generous assistance in our own style. For example, one of the radical ideas of General Learning, the subsidiary of General Electric and Time, Inc., is to concentrate on electronic devices to teach literacy to the masses of children in poor countries. We must export our great society. Our enterprises are eager to build highways and pipelines through the jungle, to multiply bases for our airplanes, and to provide other items of the American standard of living, for which the Western-trained native political leaders have rising aspirations. Unfortunately, this largesse must often result in disrupting age-old cultures, fomenting tribal wars, inflating prices and wages, and reducing decent poverty to starvation, causing the abandonment of farms and disastrous instant urbanization, making dictatorships inevitable and drawing simple peoples into great power conflicts. And woe if they do not then shape up, if they want to develop according to their own local prejudices, for example, land reform. They become an uncontrollable nuisance, surely therefore allied with our enemies, and better dead than red. In this lecture, I have singled out two trends of the dominant organization of American society. Its increasing tendency to expand meaninglessly for its own sake, and its tendency to exclude human beings as useless. It is an empty society, the obverse face of the affluent society. When Adam Smith spoke of the wealth of nations, he did not mean anything like this. The meaningless expansion and the excluding of people are different things, but in our society they are essentially related. Lack of meaning begins to occur when the immensely productive economy overmatures and lives by creating demand instead of meeting it. When the check of the free market gives way to monopolies, subsidies, and captive consumers. When the sense of community vanishes and public goods are neglected and resources despoiled. When there is made work or war to reduce unemployment. And when the measure of economic health is not increasing well-being, but abstractions like the gross national product and the rate of growth. Human beings tend to be excluded when a logistic style becomes universally pervasive, so that values and data that cannot be standardized and programmed are disregarded, when function is adjusted to the technology rather than technology to the function, when technology is confused with autonomous science, which is a good in itself, rather than being limited by political prudence, when there develops an establishment of managers and experts who alone license and allot resources, and this establishment deludes itself that it knows the only right method and is omnicompetent, then common folk become docile clients, maintained by sufferance, or they are treated as deviant. It is evident that, for us, these properties of the empty society are essentially related. If we did not exclude so many as not really persons, we would have to spend more of our substance on worthwhile goods, including subsistence goods, both at home and abroad. We would have to provide a more human environment for the children to grow up in. There would be more paths to grow up and more ways of being a person. On the other hand, if we seriously and efficiently tackled the problems of alienation, anomie, riot, pollution, congestion, urban blight, degenerative and mental disease, etc., we would find ourselves paying much more particular attention to persons and neighborhoods, rather than treating them as standard items. We would have a quite different kind of engineering and social science, and we would need all the human resources available to us. Certainly, we would stop talking presumptuously about the great society and find ourselves struggling in the confusing conditions of modern times for a decent society. The chief danger to American society at present and to the world from American society is our mindlessness, induced by empty institutions. It is a kind of mesmerism, a self-delusion of formal rightness that affects both leaders and people. We have all the talking points, but less and less content. The Americans are decent folk, generous and fairly compassionate. They are not demented and fanatical like some other imperial powers of the past and present, but on the contrary, rather skeptical and with a sense of humor. They are not properly called arrogant, though perhaps presumptuous. But we have lost our horse sense, for which we were once noted. This kind of intelligence was grounded not in history or learning, nor in finesse of sensibility and analysis, which we do not have, but in the habit of making independent judgments and in democratically rubbing shoulders with all kinds and conditions. We have lost our horse sense by becoming personnel of a mechanical system and exclusive suburbanites by getting out of contact with real jobs and real people. We suddenly have developed an establishment, but our leaders do not have the tradition and self-restraint to come on like an establishment. Thus, we are likely to wreak havoc not because of greed, ideology, or arrogance, but because of a bright strategy of the theory of gains and an impatient conviction that other people aren't quite persons.
The Empty Society, the first of the 1966 Massey Lectures by Dr. Paul Goodman, renowned American social critic. The Massey Lectures are organized by Robert McCormick and produced in New York by Del McKenzie. Ken Haslam speaking.
You may also enjoy reading the entire lecture series in a new book called The Lost Massey Lectures, Recovered Classics from Five Great Thinkers. For more information on the book, go to the CBC Radio literary website, Words at Large, at cbc.ca/wordsatlarge. In the coming weeks, we'll give you more samples of the Lost Massey Lectures. Next Friday, hear urbanist, writer, and activist Jane Jacobs with the opening lecture from her series, Canadian Cities and Sovereignty Association. I'm Sharon Farrell. Thanks for listening.
Hi, I'm Nora Young, the host of Spark on CBC Radio. What is Spark, you ask? Well,
Spark is online.
Spark is interactive.
Spark is a conversation.
Spark is digital.
Spark is a new kind of radio show.
You can check out the Spark blog, contribute to the show, and download the podcast at cbc.ca/spark.